getting our work on the soy protein, as we got into that investigation, we found that we needed very accurate control of temperatures and pHs, which is alkalinity and acidity. And it was obvious that we didn't have enough room in the chemical plant to do what we really wanted to do. So Mr. Ford had a building across from the airport on, I can't think of the name of the street that the engineering lab's on, Oakwood Boulevard. Oakwood. A building became empty there, and he said, well, let's fix that up and put our protein work over there.
Where was that again? On Oakwood Boulevard across from what?
Across from the airport.
Across from the airport?
Just
near the Dearborn Inn?
Just toward Michigan Avenue from Dearborn Inn, about a quarter of a mile down the road.
Okay, fine. So it'd be this closer to the village, right?
And he said, we can air condition that, and we've got plenty of floor space to put in our protein plant. And then later on, if we were going to make woolen fabrics out of the soy whey, we can put in a weaving miller, which is what we did. It was probably the first air-conditioned manufacturing space that Ford ever built.
Why was it air-conditioned?
Because our protein was so heat-sensitive.
It was?
And we wanted everything just right, and he didn't care what it cost, I guess. So.
You were taking the protein and somehow fashioning it into thread.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or fiber.
Fiber.
Yeah.
Spinning it like a spin rayon.
Mm-hmm.
And
had that been done before?
It had been done with milk protein in Italy.
Ah.
And when we heard about that, we immediately decided, let's see if we can do it with soy, and it looked like we could. Mm-hmm. And we did. And we spun fibers at that 1938 World's Fair in New York. We had a spinning unit, an operation there. Because it was kind of an interesting operation.
39?
Or 39, whenever it was.
Right, 39, 40, yeah.
Yeah, we had it.
At the Ford exhibit.
Yeah.
At
mm-hmm.
the World's Fair
we got
Flushing Meadows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had quite a few patents based on that. And so it was.
Now. As this process took form, how did you and Mr. Ford envision that it would be used for these soy fibers?
Well, the Ford car, even the cheapest one,
mm-hmm.
had to use expensive mohair on the sidewalls of the car.
Interior side.
At the interior, you couldn't use cotton thread, which was much cheaper.
What was mohair?
Mohair comes from a special goat.
It does.
Yeah, yeah. It's an animal.
Okay, the mohair
protein. It's an animal protein fiber.
Mm-hmm.
So wool is too,
mm-hmm.
but mohair is stiffer.
Yes.
And in order to keep the sidewall upholstery from marking is what we call it. Every time you'd brush a cotton one, you'd leave marks.
Mm-hmm.
So they were forced to use expensive mohair for car, and I think. They use something like $7 a car.
Did all automobiles in the United States use mohair?
Yep. This was before nylon really got
right.
going and all that.
Yeah.
And this is what we were shooting for, was to replace mohair and eventually wool,
mm-hmm.
too. And this manufacturing space, air-conditioned as it was, it turned out to be our... defeated us because the Air Force came in right after Pearl Harbor when we were getting set for war,
mm-hmm.
and said we need this air conditioned manufacturing space to make Pratt and Whitney engine parts, which Ford had a big contract to
uh-huh.
in the Rouge plant. They built a special building where producing
uh-huh.
Pratt and Whitney radial
right.
engines. But there were some of those parts had to be so accurate, 1/10 of an inch and that sort of thing, that they had to have air-conditioned space for the tooling.
Mm.
So they came out and took our building away from us.
And they needed it for the Pratt & Whitney airplane contract?
Well, I think the parts were used in the engine somewhere.
Oh. Which parts?
Oh, I don't know what they were. I never got into that.
I'm still not sure why they took your building away.
Because tolerances were so small or so close on the airplane engines.
Mm-hmm.
10 thousandths of an inch was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That they couldn't be warm one day and cold the next. It had to be the same temperature all the time in order to reproduce these parts that were accurate enough.
In effect, they displaced you. The only air-conditioned building in the area. They needed the air conditioning.
Yeah,
okay.
And besides, we were doing post-war work, which wasn't vital to the war effort either.
So did they take your building or your conditioning unit?
No, they took the building.
The whole building.
Yeah.
Now, was this just north of the Dearborn Inn?
Yeah.
About where the present-day engineering center is? The gate?
That's right. That's right where it was.
Okay, right across Village Road. Yeah.
We had the first building there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, as I said before, everything came to a head at the time. Edsel became ill.
Well, no, don't go so fast. I want to move you back to about 1938. You're making these fibers for what reason?
To synthetic wool.
Fine. And what are you doing with the synthetic wool? What are you doing with the fibers? Are you weaving it into a cloth?
We finally installed a complete weaving plant where we took our spun fibers,
uh-huh,
cut them to the same length as wool, about an inch,
uh-huh,
twisted them into threads,
uh-huh,
and put them through a loom and made cloth out of them.
Okay. What did you do with the cloth?
Put it in the cars. We never quite got to that point. That was the intent.
You were thinking of replacing mohair.
Wool.
And wool with the synthetic soybean fiber.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a piece of cloth.
So you took these fibers and you wove it into a, from what you show me here, a rather handsome piece of synthetic fiber.
This is actually 65% wool, 35% soy.
I see. Okay. 65% wool and 35% soy fiber. Okay. This looks like it might have been used for interior automobile upholstery.
Yeah, if we'd left out that stripe, it could have been. But this was actually made as a stunt. Mr. Ford wanted a suit out of it, and I had suits made for my kids and all that. It was a trial run at a textile plant on the east.
Oh, it wasn't done.
We sent them the fiber.
You did.
But we bought textile equipment, which we installed in the in this plant in the engineering setup there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we were intending to produce stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
But we got shut down.
But before you did, you produced enough of it to have a test run.
Oh yeah, we made test runs
at a textile mill. Mm-hmm. Whereabouts in Massachusetts?
Well, we had at the Cheney Silk Mill in Manchester, Connecticut, right outside of Hartford.
How do you spell the name of the mill?
Cheney. It was a very famous silk mill.
Mm-hmm.
And we also found that these fibers blended in very, very well with rabbit fur for making men's felt hats.
Really?
So the Hat Corporation of America, what turned out, they took all the fiber we could make, it wasn't very much, and they would blend it in with the
rabbit fur,
and they actually had them on the market
to make the felt,
yeah,
but a different composition.
But you see, rabbit fur was very expensive and also very dirty, and people got sick and all that.
What was the felt composed of before this process came along?
Mostly rabbit fur.
Just rabbit fur. But this gave it a certain body and
it was cleaner operationally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They had hoped eventually to get it 100%.
Let's go back to that suit of clothes that you had made for Mr. Ford. There's been a lot of written about that, and you actually had a suit of clothes made out of.
He had his own tailor, you know.
Right. Okay.
And we brought the cloth back to the tailor, and he made it up.
In Dearborn?
Yeah.
And it was what were the percentages again?
Well, and this one is near as I can recall, 65 wool, 35 soy.
And that was the same composition as Mr. Ford's suit?
Yeah.
Did he actually wear it?
Oh, yeah. I had one, too.
Did you?
We had overcoats for my kids.
Overcoats made out of the same composition?
Yeah, we made them look like camel's hair.
I see.
You could dye this any color you wanted, of course.
You could dye it, huh? As it once it became a...
It's a protein fiber. Right. That's the difference between that and cotton or rayon, which are cellulosic fibers.
Right, but what do they? They're dyed also.
Oh yeah, but they don't have the body. They'll crease and wrinkle and that sort of thing. Whereas
this was wrinkle resistant.
Yeah.
An early.
Well, it's more like wool. It was compatible with wool. It wouldn't. If you put rayon in there with wool, it would.
Yeah.
Would wrinkle and be.
So it was compatible with wool and made sort of a. Sort of a, what did they used to call the suits later on that became so durable? In any event, it made a very durable and occasionally and partially wrinkle-free fabric.
Yeah, it had what they call hand or draping ability.
Really?
Which cellulosic fibers do not have.
Uh-huh.
And we were just lucky that our soy protein fibers.
You mean it hung well like good wool,
right.
Wool would do.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
What happened to Mr. Ford's soybean suit? Do you have any idea?
No, of course, he was having clothes made all the time, so.
He made quite a few, more than one suit?
Probably.
Of this material?
Yeah, he probably. He had one style that he always liked.
Of course.
And I don't know whether he deviated much from that or not.
And you think he had an overcoat made? Possibly. You said your kids had
I don't know about him. I know my kids did.
Did you? How about yourself?
I didn't have a coat made. As I recall it, we only had a small limited quantity of this camel hair stuff.
Yeah. Hmm. You made other configurations besides the imitation camels.
Mm-hmm.
I see. What other types of fabrics?
Oh, we made silk ties.
Silk ties?
Shaney Silk Mills was noted for their silk and especially their ties.
I see.
Tie fabrics.
Uh-huh.
So we made quite a few of those.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
They made them up for you?
Yeah.
Okay. You could dye those, of course.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did it lend itself well to dyeing?
Oh, yes. That's one of the basics of protein.
Uh-huh.
And it dyes easily and holds fast. And
holds it, the color. Holds
it,
the color
yeah,
fast.
It blends well with animal protein fibers. That
That's
was the point.
No one had ever thought of this before. Or no one had ever tried it anyway.
No, that's... Yeah.
It may have been existed in theory, but no one had ever done it on a scale that you were doing.
No. The Italian people, with their casein
mm-hmm.
milk protein fiber,
which is
had commercial operation.
Another sludge or weight up thing. Yeah.
And the Hat Corporation, or not the Hat Corporation, but the National Dairy Company in this country
mm-hmm.
put in an operation for making... fibers from milk casein.
From milk casein.
Mm-hmm.
CAS. Spell it for the transcriber. Casein.
What? Okay. CASEIN.
EIN. Right. Okay.
Casein. Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. So your kids wore soybean fiber clothes.
Mm-hmm.
You wore.
I had a suit.
A suit.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Ford made.
We had a lot of hats. Of course.
A lot of hats.
Yeah.
Did you make them, or did the American Hat?
They made them. They had their own felting machines.
Of course. Well, felt was a process, not a fiber.
That's right. It's a process.
It was only a process. I always thought that felt was the actual material that the hats were made out of.
No, it's made out of, well, for hats, it's made out of rabbit fur. For pool tables, for instance, it's made out of wool.
Wool, completely?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the felting process, is that still being done in
mm-hmm.
this country?
Mm-hmm.
Is it still rabbit fur?
It is for hats, yeah. They haven't found anything
That's incredible.
Since we went out of business with this. But, of course, hats went out of style. They don't...
They're not as making as many as they used to. So thank heavens the rabbits are safe for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They never found anything else besides this to use in hats
except
rabbit fur. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. So felting was the process of pressing the...
They would suck the fibers in an airstream
mm-hmm.
over a cone... which had a screen on it,
uh-huh.
and an approximate shape of the hat,
uh-huh.
the bowl and the
right.
and the rim,
mm-hmm.
and it would after they build up to whatever thickness they wanted on the screen,
uh-huh.
then they would take it off and build a new one, and again, they had it mechanized, so it was
and that
very
process
fast.
Has not changed since those
yeah.
days.
Mm-hmm.
They're still doing it the same way.
As far as I know.
Incredible.
As they say, they're not making many hats.
Well. Great. So there you are. You've come up with a commercially viable process. It may not be financially viable, but Mr. Ford was willing to experiment.
Right. We, at the time, wool was selling for $1.10 or something a pound, which is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
This was way back, you see.
Mm-hmm. This was about 1939.
Yeah. And there was several dollars worth in a standard Ford body, Ford car.
Of wool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a chance, we thought, of providing an economic saving there of some
right.
sort. And we never got a chance to prove it.
Why was that? Oh, because
it shut down.
Well, now, what year did the government take over your plant?
43. That's when I left Ford.
Well, you had now you got 3 years there that you're doing a lot of this.
Well, yeah, but it took a lot of time.
Oh, it did. Okay.
I mean, it just wasn't that easy.
Of course, it didn't happen overnight.
Right.
Right. So you were working out this process over a period of about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
38 to 43, something like
mm-hmm.
that, 5 years.
Our problem was always to try to develop more tensile strength on the soy fiber.
Yes.
Wool, we could get within about 80% of the strength of wool.
You could.
Yeah. But our wet strength was always a little low.
And so you needed an additional.
And that was what we were spending most of our time on, was trying to develop higher tensile strength, both wet and dry.
Now, all through this, you had the unquestioned support of Mr. Ford. He must have been fascinated by the things
he
you
was,
were doing
yeah.
there.
Oh, yeah.
And he must have spent an awful lot of time with you
mm-hmm.
as these became more complex, more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. What was his reaction to the progress you were making?
Well, he was fascinated with it. Every morning, he
yes.
would be in my office there in the chemical plant, even sometimes before I got there.
In the
village.
He'd come across Michigan Avenue from Fairlane.
And many mornings I'd come there, his car would be out in front, and he'd be there at the table. I think there's a picture of us at the table
yes,
looking
right,
at
famous
that.
One, right. Uh-huh.
And from there, well, he'd say, well, what happened yesterday? Or
uh-huh.
He followed that pretty close.
Would he read your printed daily reports?
Yep.
He would.
Somewhere in there, or somewhere, I have a picture of him on his 75th birthday reading one of our lab report books.
I've seen that.
Right. On his knee. Without glasses.
Without glasses.
Without
That's
glasses.
Interesting, because he always put them on to read, didn't he?
Yeah. But he had Ed, his photographer.
Bacon?
No.
Ebling.
George Ebling.
Uh-huh.
He had him with him on his 75th birthday, and he came down to our lab and he said, take a picture of me reading this notes. And he took one without his glasses.
Was he rather vain about that, I see.
Yeah, I think
Yeah, because only one or two pictures of him in his glasses.
That same day, he as he was walking out the door, he said, come on, Bob, I'll race you over to the soybean plant, the extraction plant.
Oh, my God.
Which was 150 feet over.
Up on Oakwood Boulevard.
No, this was a early.
Oh, the one across the way.
Across the way. Where
across
he,
the railroad.
Where
yeah.
he had put the shovel of coals.
Yeah.
And he got a head start on me, and he beat me.
Uh-huh.
But this was his 75th birthday.
Wow.
So these are all little anecdotes.
Marvelous. give us a sort of a picture of Mr. Ford, say, 1938, his 37th birthday. Which was it, 37 or 38?
Must have been around 38 or
yeah,
something.
Big celebration. Was he in pretty good physical
yeah.
shape?
He'd had one sickness where he was in the hospital, and I didn't see him for a month or more.
I think he was an operation for
something. He kept it very quiet. I never really knew what it was, a hernia or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But
it was a hernia.
I never really got into it.
Henry Ford Hospital.
Yeah. But other than that, as far as I know, he was always in good shape. Of course, he was quite a food fetisher, I guess.
Yes.
He was not a true vegetarian, but he didn't think
pretty close.
He was pretty close. Yeah.
Tell us about the adapting the soybean mash to edible foods, which he was apparently very very much interested in. And if you can tell us a bit about the famous soybean menus that were prepared.
Well, of course there were a lot of them. Have you ever read Dr. Ruddiman's reports?
Well, I want to ask you about Edsel Ruddiman.
Because he's the one that really put on those soybean dinners.
Now, Edsel Ruddiman had come to work for Mr. Ford in the, I think, the late 20s or the mid-20s. He had been his brother-in-law, or was his brother-in-law?
Maybe,
no,
I don't know.
No, no.
They
well,
were school chums. They were, went
more,
to school together.
They were school chums at the old Scott Sullivan School.
Yeah.
School seatmates, I believe.
Yeah, I think they were.
Yeah, and so he had gone off to get his doctorate in chemistry,
mm-hmm.
had he not, at Johns Hopkins or somewhere, and or he taught at Johns Hopkins for a while. I
never knew his history, but it was.
And then somehow Mr. Ford asked him to come back to work for him.
Yeah, that's true, and he set up a private laboratory for him and converted an old house there.
Yeah, where was that?
It's on the rear of the engineering building. You know where the service department is? You know where Ray Dallinger's office used to be?
I'm not sure. You mean the engineering laboratory?
Yeah.
Okay.
But in the back of that
mm-hmm.
was what they call a garage and a service department
yeah,
and
uh-huh.
odds and ends of things.
Was it near the radio station building, which is still standing?
Yeah. There was a house near that.
A frame house?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was converted into a laboratory for Dr. Redmond.
I see. Now that's gone.
Probably is,
yeah. All that's left back there is the old WWI
yeah.
Radio station.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. And that's where Dr. Edsel Redmond had his...
Yeah. And he even had a dining room in there so that they could serve some small meals or small
okay.
groups. But
how did Mr. Ford decide that he wanted to experiment in using soybeans as a as food for humans?
Well, he was always, as I say, he was always interested in food,
right?
And of course, we heard these stories that the Chinese nation, they lived on soy protein. That was
right.
their main source of protein.
Right.
And
it was a hardy crop, immune to insect and...
It's quite easy to grow, really.
Light and easy to grow.
Yeah. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that intrigued Mr. Ford was that it was a legume, which means that it could use nitrogen from the air
uh-huh.
through these bacteria on the root system,
uh-huh.
which... Of course, nitrogen is the most expensive part of the fertilizer, so,
so
it saves some that way.
You didn't have to fertilize it very much.
Not very much, but
is that
as
fertilizer?
It turned out, they are fertilizing a little bit, but the soybean grows so well now, we're getting so many bushels per acre that we're eating up the ground. They have to replenish them.
It does
yeah.
deplete the soil
yeah.
of nitrogen.
In the early days, we were lucky to get 15 to 16 bushels to. Per acre, but now they make 50 or even 100. I've seen figures. Yeah.
But it does use the nitrogen up.
Oh, and when that, yeah.
Wholesale, yeah. Well, I'm interested in these soybean menus. Wasn't there also a little, wasn't there a executive dining room at the engineering laboratory?
There was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But first, the first menus were tried out in Dr. Redmond's frame.
Well, where I first.
Behind the engineering
yeah.
lab. Uh-huh.
He and I worked together quite well.
I wondered.
And
right.
he was more interested in the food end than we were in the industrial end.
Right, okay.
But he and I went to the first soybean conference in Washington, D.C. together.
Really? When you say the first nationally held scientific conference on
soybean,
the uses of the soybean?
They formed the Soybean Association of America. And the first conference.
Who did?
The father of the soybean, his name was Roy Morris.
M-O-R-S?
No, Roy... No, Bill Morris, W.J. Morris, M-O-R-S-E.
Okay, good.
He worked for the Department of Agriculture.
Okay.
And he went over to China and brought back 3,000 varieties of soybean.
Good heavens.
And the Agricultural Department had an experimental farm in Holgate, Ohio, and they planted these 3,000 varieties down there. I went down to see them.
As a test, an experimental farm. Huh?
An experimental farm. They wanted to classify the varieties, which for maturing dates, times, and all that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
one were frost resistant, and
right.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they hoped to get one that would taste good, too. And they never I went down to see that farm.
Did
but
you and Mr. Dr. Redmond go down together?
Not to that farm, but he and I went out to Washington
okay.
for this first meeting,
mm-hmm.
as far as I know, it was the first annual meeting.
Mm-hmm. And you were astounded by the apparent possibilities involved with soybean. Before, had Mr. Ford become interested in soybean before this conference?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
A couple of years.
That's why we went.
Yeah, okay, good.
It was...
So you learned...
Yeah, we saw leather-like products that the Chinese make.
Uh-huh.
They make what what we would call, you know, the skin that forms on milk when you boil it?
Right.
Well, they boiled soy milk over there and got these tough skins. And they make delicacies, food delicacies out of them, but they also looked like leather. And this, we were interested, you know, in trying an industrial.
Did it have the consistency of leather?
Well, yeah, but it wasn't permanent. As long as you had water in there, it was quite good.
But once it dried out, it
just
became brittle.
Yeah.
Okay, good. That's good.
But this sparked our interest, and we always figured, well, maybe we learn how to do this right, we can come up with a synthetic leather.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting to note, when the war hit, the first things that went on ration were protein products.
What?
Leather? Well, they're the scarcest thing we have. We can't live without them.
Mm-hmm.
And they immediately become scarce. And
what are basic protein products?
Well, leather and wool right away went on rationing in the war. One of the very first things. You couldn't get a pair of shoes without...
Leather and wool are considered protein?
They are. They're animal protein.
Animal protein. Okay.
And
I'm thinking of vegetable protein.
Well, that's the difference, you see. We're approaching it from the vegetable.
Okay.
We don't want to have to go through an animal.
Right.
Because the animal is too inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
And as the population grows, we're going to be forced to eat the soybean stuff, whether we like it or not.
Right. So the war rationed animal protein products immediately because of the potential scarcity of the animals.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
Good.
Well, not only that, of the products, they're expensive products to start with because the animal is so inefficient. You know, it takes about 20 pounds of feed to go into an animal to get back one that's useful.
Get back what?
Well, say you put 20 pounds of feed into a cow and you want a pound of meat.
Oh, meat, okay.
Or milk, or any
okay.
Edible.
Whatever is product.
Yeah, it's an inefficient process.
Edible or usable product.
Right.
Okay. So how did you propose to...
Well, we didn't know. We knew we could make leather-like products, and we knew we could make plastic products under heat and pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we thought we knew we could make pretty good synthetic fibers, wool-like fibers. And these are things that we were working on all the time.
This is very important, but I'm fascinated, I've always been fascinated by, and I know this may seem trivial to you in retrospect, but I'm fascinated by those soybean menus, which I'm sure no one really liked, because at that time...
I didn't like them, I know.
And so Henry Ford had Dr. Edsel Ruddiman trying to come up with an edible soybean menu, and I believe the whole meals were fashioned.
Right, they were. Yeah.
Now, these were pretty much soybean mash that you were using as a basic substance, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And somebody, perhaps Mr. and Mrs. Ruddiman, were attempting to come up with soybean milk, right? Soybean soup.
Right.
Soybean...
Croquettes, I remember.
Croquettes, so simulated meat products, soybean bread, soybean butter, soybean ice cream,
salad,
soybean cake, soybean salad. So you'd have this basic, very adaptable but unappetizing mush that you had to somehow simulate or by flavoring, pretend that these were these familiar shapes and products. Well, that Dr. Ruddiman must have been very ingenious to come up with these menus or these simulated foods.
He was a good food chemist, and all that.
Yeah.
But
did he flavor them?
Yeah, oh sure. Yeah.
Flavor them with the flavor of say meat.
Yeah, we could smoke them, for instance.
You could smoke them. Okay.
That was the easiest way to cover up
uh-huh.
some of those objectionable tastes.
Well, let me just ask him, what was the taste that was so objectionable? Was it the rancid oil?
Rancid oil.
It was the rancid oil, which oxidized it very quickly.
Yeah, the minute you crust the bean, if you let oxygen hit it,
gone.
Yeah, almost within a minute, this flavor developed.
Would it be something that would make you nauseous, or did you like to regurgitate?
Oh, no, but you couldn't eat too many mouthfuls of it.
Okay, fine. Now, did Mr. Ford, I'm sorry to press you on this, what seems a very trivial aspect of it, but we have these printed menus, and we have these articles that we've reprinted many times for people. Did Mr. Ford insist that some of you be guinea pigs in these soybean dinners?
Not, he never made me.
He never asked you to eat it, okay.
I did, though.
Would you go over to Rudiman's laboratory house?
Yeah.
The laboratory house, yeah.
We finally made the milk down in our lab because we had,
right.
We
had
could extract the protein and we,
right.
We could make the milk there. And but it still wasn't good enough. Today, we can do it. Word that was coined for the, I guess you'd call it scientific agricultural people at the time, but we spelled it CHEMURGIC. And we had the, about 3 years later, I think in 1934 or so, we had the National Comergic Conference at Dearborn Inn.
Yes.
And I was in charge of the program for that.
Were you really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. We still have the proceedings.
Yeah. Yes, because I remember Irenae DuPont was very prominent in the movement.
Uh-huh.
And he came out to attend the conference, and Mr. Ford spent a lot of time with him. And before that, though, you know, the DuPonts were anathema to Henry Ford. He and they and the big banks. He didn't trust them. You know.
Well, of course, they owned part of General Motors.
Yeah.
Right.
And he was always dead set against those New York bankers.
Mm-hmm.
But he broke away from that, and I think he became quite friendly with Irenae DuPont.
Good. Mm-hmm.
But
so the plant is open.
The plant was open. We didn't spend much time on wood, really.
It was right in the middle of Greenfield Village. Or on the
right next to the sawmill.
Sawmill, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
or what was to become Greenfield.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
The village had not been dedicated yet. See, that I think it was dedicated on the 50th anniversary of Edison's first successful electric light bulb.
Mm-hmm. The incandescent light bulb.
So it was in 28, wasn't it, when the village was dedicated?
29,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. November.
That's right, 1 week before the crash.
Right.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in the village at the time.
Well, where were you living?
At the Jordan Boarding House.
Okay.
I should have mentioned that. When Ford offered me this opportunity to manage this chemical plant, he also at the same time said, well, why don't you live out here at the Jordan Boarding House? And so I moved out there and did.
Now, was Jimmy Humberstone?
Yeah, he was.
Was there? And was he married yet?
Yeah, he was married. He used to come over and visit me in my room, and we played chess together in the evenings.
Ah, okay.
I haven't seen him for a long time. He was living here in St. Pete for a while, but
I
didn't see him.
Had his son been born yet?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Jordan?
That's right.
Junior? Mm-hmm. I mean, Jordan Howerstone.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I didn't realize it, but he was about to get a divorce from his first wife there.
I see.
But getting back to the chemical plant,
yes.
Ford had become interested in farm crops and helping the farmer find new uses for his farm crops. And so the theme of our laboratory then changed to... the purpose was changed to try to find industrial uses for farm crops. And to that, in order to get started on that, Mr. Ford said, well, what do you suppose we can do with carrots? It was one day.
Mm-hmm.
So the next morning.
You should drop by and you'd sit around brainstorming.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the next morning I came in and here about 4 or 5 truckloads of carrots had been dumped right in front of the lab. He said, He said, "I'll see what you can do with those." The first thing he thought of was to try to put it through the retort and, uh-huh, you know, destructive distill it.
Uh-huh.
Well, it soon became apparent to all of us that most of the average farm crops had too much water in them to really get any good out of them.
Uh-huh.
And we couldn't find any anything that was of very much value. We could always make a little bit of, say, alcohol or,
mm-hmm,
acetic acid or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing in that was economical or practical. Until we got to the soybean.
You tried how many vegetable compounds?
Oh, gee, everything. I remember he must have had 100 truckloads of tomatoes one time.
You dumped them in front?
Right in
front. Drivers dumped,
yeah,
them in front?
And
what would you do? Would you the scoops?
Well, what we finally did was we just squeezed them, made tomato juice out of them. That's the only way. Of course, that was an edible.
Quite a job scooping them up and bringing them into the distillate area.
Yeah, we didn't have conveyors or anything.
No.
But that was Ford's method, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He often said to me, he said, "I can't look at anything smaller than an elephant."
That's interesting.
Yeah, he said that.
He thought rather large. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he had a lot of other interesting ideas. For instance, he wanted us to record our notes every day. And he had a distant relative, a nephew or second nephew, named Ed Litigot, who was a printer by trade.
Litogot. Mm-hmm. One of his wife's family.
Is it his wife's family?
Right,
I
yeah.
wasn't clear.
Mary Litigot was his mother.
Okay.
Yeah. Not his wife, his mother. Mary Litigot was his mother.
I see.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, Ed was a printer and he was out of a job, so Mr. Ford had a printing press installed in our laboratory, and Ed Litigot got a job there, and his job was to print up our notes every day. We had them printed.
Wow.
And we had them in book form.
He would set the type?
Set the type. And
From your pencil,
from our, yeah,
ink notes?
Yeah.
Well, that's a big job.
Oh, yeah. But, and that's the way Ford operated.
Sure.
You can't even find that today. I guess with the word processors, you might.
Yeah. Right.
But that was his way of word processing, in effect. But until we got to the soybean, we really didn't have anything that meant anything to anybody.
Was
it was a good experience.
Pardon?
It was a good experience for us.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And man this laboratory, he said, "Well, let's get some of the brighter, best students from the Ford Trade School." And he said, "Go down and pick out some that you know and look over the records, and as we need, we'll bring them out here and get them in the school. And they can, if they're interested in chemistry, fine."
Was chemistry a part of the trade school curriculum?
They had a course in it, but nothing. It wasn't very major.
Yeah.
But just enough to know the metallurgy of iron and steel, that sort of thing.
Right. Okay.
So as we got busy and as we had to handle more tomatoes and that sort of thing, we needed more students, more help.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, at the same time, Ford had started a sort of a trade school out at Wayside Inn. And we brought about 12 of those boys out. And Calvert was one of them. Frank Calvert, have you run across him? Well, he was one of them. He's quite a soybean expert now, too.
Calvert.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He was a young chemistry student.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But at one time, we had over 100 boys working in that lab. But our basic crew was probably 12 to 15.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, until we got to the soybean, we really didn't have any solid progress that meant anything.
Now, the soybean came up in a normal progression going through all the vegetables that were available?
Yeah, it.
Or was that
soybean special? Was practically unknown in those days.
That's why I'm in this country?
Yeah, in this country.
Okay.
And
in the United States?
As I recall, it may have been 40,000 or 50,000 acres growing, maybe not even that much.
Uh-huh. They were usually largely for feed, weren't they?
Yeah, feed and Well, the oil wasn't very good. In those days, we didn't know how to process the oil. It had a bad flavor, and it would go off flavor
very quickly. Yeah.
So, but the soybean had very little water. In fact, it's 12% or less.
Oh, okay.
And,
so very dense.
Yeah. And we knew that the protein from the soybean was similar in some ways to the protein in milk. And so that got us thinking on what would we do with the soybean protein if we wanted to. And of course that led to plastics and all that sort of thing.
Can I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes.
And ask one, two questions. What about this mythic story that we've heard all these years that Mr. Ford one day discovered a book by a couple of British authors on the soybean and its possible uses?
It's possible.
You don't remember that?
I don't recall the details. It's very likely that's what happened, that he read about it in some journal or book or something.
Right.
And I remember him talking to me about it. He said, wonder how we can get a hold of some, or something like that.
And oh, I see.
So we went out and got some somewhere. And I guess you could buy them in a feed store or something like that. And we got to studying anyway, whatever we could find on soybeans, and there was a plant in Chicago that had been built that was along the lines of a chemical plant. They were using solvents to extract the oil out of the bean. Most of the bean processing up to that time was done in presses. Very inefficient, and squeezed out the oil, and then the cake was ground up and fed to animals.
Mm-hmm.
And in Decatur, Illinois, which is the home of the soybean, the soybean center of the country,
at that time,
there were two or three of these, what they called expeller plants. They were the screw press, which would squeeze them under terrific pressure, and you get the oil.
The oil was thrown away, or what was it used for?
No, it was used for a while. It was used for soap, and they tried to make salad oil or shortening out of it, but the flavor was very bad. But they could, use a percentage of it along with cottonseed oil and make a saleable product, but it wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
Soybean oil always sold cheaper than the others.
The residue, or the cake, as you call it, was fed to pigs and
farm animals.
Yeah, as regular silage.
Well, it was their protein feed.
Oh, their protein feed.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
But we wanted to get the protein pure, so in the lab we developed our own process for extracting the oil, and
is
then
it different from the expellers.
Oh yeah, we used hexane solvent. We like dry cleaning.
Okay.
We actually dissolved. We'd flake the beans and run them through a pipe that was full of hexane on an angle and the screw in it.
How do you spell hexane?
H-E-X-A-N-E.
This is a solvent.
It's a distillate out of the petroleum.
Okay.
It just has a very narrow boiling range.
Mm-hmm.
66 degrees centigrade it boils. The Ford extractor, however, got quite a lot of attention. And in one of those pictures in there, you can see the old extraction building. We built it across the street from the chemical plant. It was about 150 feet away.
Uh-huh.
And wanted it all by itself because everybody was afraid of fire.
Uh-huh.
And all we did was we built a roof shelter to cover the equipment, but no walls, because we wanted it to, to get...
What year was that built?
I'm trying to think, probably 33,
mm-hmm.
because we had a model of it at the World's Fair in New York.
You did?
We made a glass model,
mm-hmm.
and on a table,
uh-huh.
and showed that at the World's Fair.
Uh-huh.
But... from the oily-free flakes that emerged from this unit. Mm-hmm. We then extracted the protein from that. We developed a process for doing that. And that was about 1933.
Now, for me, how did this process work again? You took the actual bean and then what did you do?
We ran it through rollers, flattened them out, and made flakes.
Okay.
And then those flakes were fed into a bath of this hexane, which was contained in our case, it was a 12-inch pipe.
Uh-huh.
On a 30-degree angle.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to upright at one end where the flakes dropped in until a screw picked them up and took them up. And at the top end of the pipe, we had a steam jacket on it, so we boiled off the hexane. And then the flakes emerged oil-free.
That is, so in effect, the hexane extracted the oil.
Yeah, and the hexane was recovered.
Recovered.
We put it through a still, and the oil came out the bottom of the still, and the hexane came over, then condensed and recycled.
Good heavens, that's marvelous. So you recovered the oil, and you recovered...
The hexane.
The hexane as well to be used again.
Used over and over and over. And we actually had a working model at the Chicago World's Fair.
Doing that.
Yeah. As I say, they would never let you do that today. too dangerous. Actually, the first big plant in this country was in Chicago, and it blew up.
Oh my
destroyed
God.
A whole block of buildings.
Oh my God.
Killed a lot of people.
You mean because of the low flash point?
Something happened, and the vapor accumulated in the spark.
Or the vapor, yeah. And
I went over to see that plant.
To see why it happened.
Yeah, just learn all we could from it. Because it was a setback at the time.
It's dangerous.
Well, it is. But
fortunately, you didn't allow smoking out there, so that helped.
Well, there's some anecdotes here. As I said, our first plant had no walls on it, just a roof.
Right.
Well, we soon got too cold, so we decided to enclose it in, and there was a boiler right alongside.
Oh, my God.
And the safety department men from the Rouge plant came out one day, I don't know why, somebody must have tipped them off, and they said, oh, you're going to have to close you down, you can't do anything. So when Ford heard about it,
what would have been the possible result, and how would it have occurred?
Well, we could have blown that plant up.
With how, though?
Well, an accidental spark. In those days, our light switches, we didn't have safety design light switches or anything else.
Sparks.
Anything that might get us back.
Okay, and would have exploded. What's the flammable?
The vapor. The hexane would flash off as a vapor, and then it becomes just
it
like.
It wasn't all enclosed though, and it was.
Well, the vapor was supposed to be enclosed in our pipes,
right.
But they always have leaks, you know.
Okay, all right, fine. Good.
Anyway, when Ford heard that they were going to close it down, he said, "You get that fellow out of here tomorrow." He said, "I want to talk to him." So, you know, this was a summons from the boss, so he was there,
mm-hmm.
And he said, now, Bob, bring me a pail full of hexane, which I did, I didn't know what he wanted, and he said, I want a shovel, too, and we had a shovel, because this boiler that we were using, I think we were burning coke in it, shoveling.
You wanted a pail of hexane liquid?
Hexane liquid.
Okay.
And
which you purchased from a...
Well, we bought it. And by the tank cars.
Yeah, right.
Tank.
Okay, good.
Anyway, this safety man didn't know what was happening, and when Ford put that pail down there, and he reached into the firebox and got a shovel full of red hot coke, and the safety man, he turned pale. Anyway, he took this shovel full of red hot coke and plunged it into this pail of hexane.
Oh.
I nearly died myself. Well, he knew how to do it. And all it did was put out the cool off the coke. Of course, some vapors came off. But
well, how did he know what to do and what he did? What
speed,
did
he do? The speed.
The
he
speed?
Did, he didn't give it a chance to, he didn't put it in slowly. He plunged it in and covered it up so air couldn't get at it.
Okay.
Well, anyway, the safety man turned around and he never said a word and he went back to the Rouge plant and Ford said, now don't let me hear anything like that again. But we learned our lesson. We were very, very careful from then on. We were very...
Well, since you'd gone to Chicago, or Decatur, or wherever, Chicago. And you looked and you talked to the people there.
Oh, yeah.
And you knew exactly what had happened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, we never knew where the leak was. They didn't themselves.
But obviously, it wasn't leaking. A spark had gotten to it. Huh? Yeah. Well,
There have been several others since then, too.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Now, what safety precautions did you take?
Well, the last experience I had, Ralston had six plants like that. And they divided the various operations in separate buildings. The one building that had the hexane was all by itself and went to extreme limits to have non-sparking tools and everything like that.
Yeah.
And even so, they're still scared to death of it.
Yeah.
But they haven't had any problems.
Oh,
but
good.
Some
they're still doing the same process?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Incredible.
Oh, this
process that you developed is still a standard in the industry.
Yeah, well, I won't say we developed it.
You adapted it.
We developed a small plant, put it that way. They still call it the Ford extractor.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it was a little too small to be economically competitive with these big plants.
Of course, you were doing research.
Yeah, we did 6 tons a day, whereas a big plant will do 1,500 tons a day. But we did get a good quality oil, and today the soybean oil is very quality. It's known as a quality oil, and we use it in our salad oils. Procter & Gamble uses all kinds of it in Crisco and that sort of thing.
Right. What process did you develop to get rid of the rancid properties?
Well, that again is it's an oxidation process, and we just took pains not to let air get at this oil or anything else. It's just, it was.
You kept it sealed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But now, getting the protein out and without damaging it was a much bigger problem. But we did develop a process there at the Rouge plant, or at the village chemical plant, where we actually got pure soy protein, and then from there we went and studied making plastics out of it, and eventually fibers and that sort of thing.
Well, how did this process work?
Well, the flakes were fed into a alkaline water, and after about exposure of about an hour, the protein becomes solubilized and goes off in the water, and then by centrifuges, you can take off the protein-laden water, and you get flakes or spent meal, as we call it, off the other side.
Which comes out as sort of a paste, or
well, it comes out. Yeah, I guess you'd call
like
it sludge.
Whey.
It's like a sludge.
Sludge, like whey.
Whereas the protein comes off of our filters, when we acidify that alkaline water, it coagulates and it comes out just like cottage cheese.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So.
Curds and whey.
And we got into plastics and developed a fairly good plastic out of it. Built a big department down in the Rouge plant, in the glass plant, actually.
Now, you're going too fast, Mr. Bohr.
Okay.
let's take it step by step.
All right.
You've got this sludge, you call it, this cottage cheese consistency, and what are you going to do with it?
Well, that was it. That's why I say that's led us into plastics.
But how? Can you give us sort of a
step by step? Yeah. Once we dried it, this cottage cheese, we ran it through hot air dryers, and then we ground it to a powder. Now that powder could be molded into the form of, say, horn buttons or gear shift knobs and that sort of thing.
In effect, it lends itself to extrusion molding.
Well, compression molding. Compression.
Compression molding. Yeah. Okay, fine. Yeah.
At about 2,000 pounds per square inch, and at about 300 degrees, it gets soft plastic and it will fuse together under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Our problem was getting it water insoluble enough so water wouldn't affect it.
And how did you do that?
Well, then we found that by treating it with formaldehyde, we could get it so it was fairly inert in water, but not good enough to use on the coil cover. We were trying to on the Ford distributor, if you remember the first V8 engines, you probably don't, but we used a plastic Bakelite in those days.
Right.
Bakelite coil.
Now, Bakelite was your was the standard plastic of,
right.
of that era.
It was very expensive.
Of the mid-30s.
Yeah, it was pretty expensive in those days.
Mm-hmm. What was the chemical makeup of Bakelite? Do you remember?
Phenylformaldehyde.
It was the same. Okay, mm-hmm. good. Okay, using some sort of compound as a
stiffener. We found by just treating the protein with formaldehyde, we waterproofed it about 90% of the way we wanted it, but that other 10% eluded us as far as, we never could put it on a distributor.
Now, formaldehyde was a phenyl rosin, right?
Well, phenol and cooked together with formaldehyde formed a Bakelite, formed a resin.
Yeah, resin. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, good. And that was Bakelite.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So we found that in order to get a compound that would be good enough to put on in dielectric uses like the coil and and the rotor and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no trouble with horn buttons and
no, because they we didn't care if they leaked a little electricity.
Dashboard buttons, yeah. Okay.
So, but we found that by taking phenylformaldehyde and putting a little small percentage of that in with the protein, we could get waterproof stuff.
Which would also be used for
on the dielectric system of the car.
Right.
And we had a fairly big department going on that down on the Ridge plant.
Now, this is what, mid-35?
Mm-hmm.
And you had sort of outgrown your original research area in the Greenfield Village?
Oh, no. We stayed there. It was our headquarters.
Okay, you were still there, but you were working on
divisions down in the Rouge plant.
Now, did he build you a separate plant at the Rouge?
No. Part of the old glass plant was idle.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to put the plastic operation there. And then one thing led to another, and it was decided we needed more oil for the Rouge plant. Well, incidentally, one of the other big uses for soy oil turned out to be in foundry core binders.
What?
Core binders, you know.
How do you spell that?
C-O-R-E. To make a casting of a V8 engine block.
In foundry work?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It was used as a
core binder. Core binder, yeah. And we used to use several tank cars a day down in the Rouge plant.
Good.
So,
become commercial.
Yeah, we didn't have enough soybean oil to satisfy them, so we right next to the glass plant then, there was some empty space, so Ford said, well, let's build a plant there.
Uh-huh.
And so we built a large extractor there, I think 50 ton a day or something like that.
And you had a very fancy, I've seen the photographs, very fancy storefront.
Well, that was the next plant.
Oh, okay, fine, excuse me.
This was, he still built a wooden building, right in the middle of the Rouge plant, you know. it didn't fit in with anything. But we got it going. And
next to the old glass plant addition or space.
Yeah. I think
you still use the glass plant space as well as the next building?
I doubt if they are now.
No, I mean in those days.
You
had the space originally in the glass plant, and then you build a wooden building next to it.
Right next to it. Okay. And we used the silos in the glass plant as storage for the beans.
Of course.
And we blew them over. We blew them this time instead of screw them over. And it worked out all right.
What do you mean by that? I missed
that. Well, we have an air system. It's just like we had a pipe that we could suck the beans right out of this hopper and
out of the silo?
Yeah. And we blew them over to a collecting bin in the soybean plant.
Okay.
Just as much as we needed. We didn't store many over there.
Uh-huh. Okay. A suction effect?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
Good.
And then shortly after that, it became apparent they needed more oil, and we thought we were going to need more protein for plastics. It turned out we didn't, but anyway, the old bunker building of the old coke ovens down on Miller Road became, they were not in use, and so forth. So, well, let's put a soybean plant there. And that's the building that you saw this big sign on.
Right, it had Ford soybeans.
Right on Miller Road there.
And, oh my gosh, yeah.
And it was very prominent.
Was it neon? Did it light up at night? It looks like it.
I think it did.
Yeah, right.
I think it did.
Yeah.
And that was the biggest plant we'd ever built. And that was operating, when I left it was still running.
Mm-hmm. You say, when you said bunker, what does that mean?
That's what they used to call it for handling I guess it was coal.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you've got three plants now.
Well, they had to tear the other one down, the wooden building in the Rouge plant, because they needed the ground for something else.
Oh, okay.
And that's when we moved over and the one in Miller Road.
Okay.
And there was still a very, very tall smokestack that had been servicing the coke ovens. And they tore the coke ovens out, left the stack standing. So Forrest said, well, we'll make our own power here and use that stack. But the stack was way too big for our little dinky boiler, and the vapors from the fire would only get halfway up the stack, and then they would condense and then freeze, and the first thing we knew, the whole thing was going to collapse. So
why? Was the distillate making or the vapor?
The vapor from our, I guess we were burning coke then, and there's a lot of water vapor in stack gases.
Oh, I see.
And see, if on a cold day, it would only get about halfway up this big stack and then condense inside.
Oh, my God.
And we found that the bricks were flaking off and dropping down, and we soon had to stop that.
Was this the main power plant that stacked?
Right next, no, it was a coke oven stack.
Okay.
And but it was not far from the main powerhouse.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do?
Well, I think we just put in a standard stack, the proper size.
Okay.
Just wooden or pipe. Because they had to tear the old brick stack down because it was unsafe.
Right. All seeing that being blown up, or did they tear it down?
I think they had tore it down. I think so.
Good.
But you could see we were getting into bigger operations and the
more complex
and more sophisticated. Our work out at the chemical